you can host the best backyard barbecue. When you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's B-Y-T-E.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Welcome to China Corner Office, a podcast produced in partnership with SubChina, featuring conversations with business leaders from around the world about the challenges and opportunities of doing business in China, the world's most dynamic economy. I'm Chris Marquis, a professor of business at Cornell, where I teach and research on this same topic. Every episode, we talk to an executive at a company doing business in China and explore what has led to their personal and business success, and also some of the challenges they've encountered along the way. With geopolitical tensions between the U.S. and China on the rise, understanding how business can compete in China is more important than ever. If you're interested in doing business in China or are looking for insights to adjust your current business strategy, this is the show for you. Thanks for tuning in.
Hello, everyone. I'm Chris Marquis, a professor at Cornell's Business School. Welcome to this live SubChina CEO webinar of the China Corner Office podcast, a show focused on the leaders and companies facing challenges and opportunities of doing business in China. Today, we're kicking off a new partnership with the USCBC, the US-China Business Council, a nonpartisan, nonprofit organization representing over 200 American companies doing business with China. We'll have regular webinars and podcasts, particularly focused on the intersection between business and policy and how commercial relations will be reshaped under the Biden administration. To discuss these issues today, we have two leading thinkers on U.S.-China relations, particularly in the commercial sphere. We have Craig Allen, who is president of the USCBC. Craig has a long and distinguished career in the U.S. public service, serving many positions in Beijing, Taipei, Tokyo. He's also the former ambassador to Brunei and has served as deputy assistant secretary for China in the U.S. Commerce Department. Also, we have Robert Daly, who is the director of the Wilson Center's Kissinger Institute on China and the United States. You know, Robert's work on China is really amazingly diverse. He was the star of a movie, well-known movie in the 1990s called Beijing Ren Zai Nu Ye, which is a Beijinger in New York. He's led a number of university program, China programs, and also served as an interpreter for many world leaders, including Jiang Zemin, Jimmy Carter, and Henry Kissinger. Craig and Robert, welcome to China Corner Office.
Thank you so much. With you.
Great. So, first, just sort of a set for our audience, setting sort of some of the ground rules. So, you know, please enter your questions in the Q&A feature, and we can get to those throughout the discussion, as well as probably at the end. I'm going to start with a number of questions, but please be entering your Q&A as we go. So the first question I'd like to pose to both of you, and Robert, maybe you can get us started, is in regard to communication between the two countries. You know, last week we had a phone call between President Xi and President Biden, you know, but looking at the reporting on that and the readouts, you know, very different messaging. You know, the U.S., I'll read a quote here, described it, you know, the discussion focusing on Beijing's coercive and unfair economic practices, crackdown in Hong Kong, human rights abuses in Xinjiang, and increasingly assertive actions in the region, including Taiwan. And from the China side, it was a little more positive, suggesting there's room to work together. Although my guess is none of those issues are things where there's issue room to work. I'm curious, how do you make sense of this? With such dramatically different messaging, where can the US and China work together?
Sure. Well, those readouts, the formal readouts from the State Department, from the Chinese government, are primarily for domestic consumption. And this is why the US message emphasizes Biden's toughness and his raising of the difficult issues. Right. And the Xi Jinping announcement focuses on his projected sort of very sunny view that you hear at Davos and other places, that we have a community of common destiny and that we can get together. But the entire conversation, the substantive part of a two-hour conversation in this case, lasted about an hour and a half. And so they actually covered many, many different aspects of the relationship. They talked about their domestic plans for their own domestic economies, and they explored some areas for cooperation as well. So the substance was far richer than what was reported. And of course, both leaders know that. Now, at the same time, China's very aware that while it was glad to get this message from Biden on the eve of Chinese New Year, and places like the Global Times played this up as a very friendly signal from the United States, earlier that afternoon, President Biden had been at the Department of Defense, where he announced that Eli Ratner would be leading a fast-tracked review of our military capabilities, our posture toward China. So that the correspondence of those two events can't have been missed. I have been told that while President Biden gave a fairly complete readout of his domestic and international plans to Xi Jinping, including talking about Hong Kong and Xinjiang, that the Chinese response was pretty formulaic. It was very much like the Yang Jiechi speech earlier in the week. There was a sense that it was on the United States to get back with the proper program, to realize that there's nothing threatening about China's rise. And then lastly, Xi Jinping came back to his prescription of no conflict, no confrontation, mutual respect, and win-win. Mm-hmm. Now, what's striking about that was exactly the formula for the new model of major power relations that China put out and that America pretty clearly rejected back in 2013. Not that there's anything wrong with any one piece of that. Nobody would, wants confrontation. But the Chinese side is saying, on the one hand, that everything has changed over the past 4 years, and yet we have the same formula, no new ideas yet. That said, it's early days, and this is largely about signaling at this stage.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. I think signaling to domestic versus the international competitors. Craig, do you have anything to add to that?
I would just add that preceding the two presidents' discussion, there was an earlier discussion by the Secretary of State and Yang Jiechi, and that was really, in a sense, setting the structure and the format for the latter discussion. And that was very important because it set the foundation on a number of structural issues. The U.S. acceptance of the One China policy, the fact that we were going to compete as well as to cooperate, and setting some really strong guidelines there for both leaders to respect the other's red lines, so that we can move forward to a more collaborative agenda, possibly in the future, at least insofar as we're dealing with common global challenges. So I think that the two leaders put us in a good spot to move the relationship forward on a much more firm foundation.
Great. Let's talk about some of those areas of potentially moving forward on the firm foundation. One of the reasons we're getting together is, recently the USCBC and the Wilson Center, had an event, and I think actually a sort of report out as well, on the topic of bridging economic and national security interests. And I think, over the past 4 years, these have been maybe conjoined in a little bit more deeper way than they will be in the future. And I'm curious, if just some of the insights from those discussions, and maybe where some of the areas where there might be change for the US and China to be working together more collaboratively, more constructively. Maybe Craig, you can start on this one.
Okay. So bridging our national security and our economic interests is a real big challenge, because the national security side and the economic side have been going in opposite directions recently. And the national security debate has overwhelmed to a certain extent the economic debate. And it's useful to recalibrate and to take a look at how we can achieve both our national security objectives without compromising on our economic objectives. Both are very, very important. I think that the incoming Biden administration has articulated very well that the economic interests, and that is jobs for American working families, is of paramount concern. And it is, I think, a well understood truth that many jobs were lost in the United States in the recent trade dispute. Our research suggests that up to 250,000 jobs were lost as a result of the tariffs and the economic conflict, without necessarily furthering our national security interests. And so bridging the interests and satisfying both our national security and our economic interests is an important task, and one that we can do if we recalibrate. And the conference was looking at the various elements of that, from geopolitics to cybersecurity to Congress to global warming and climate and technology policies as well. And so all of these areas are contested, all are important areas of policy debate. And I'm confident that the speakers at the conference all contributed practical suggestions in moving forward to advance our economic interests without sacrificing any of the national security concerns that we may have.
Great. Any examples of maybe things that might change to as sort of maybe the economic and national security are separated a bit? You know, there's a variety of things in the news, from, you know, TikTok and WeChat to, you know, listing of Chinese firms to, you know, other actions against other companies. Is there, you know, any sense of things that might be changing in the near future, or recommendations of things that potentially could change?
I think that the relatively confrontational approach of the Trump administration satisfied neither our national security or our economic concerns. And so I think a change of tone here and a civil conversation between both the secretaries, foreign ministers, if you will, and the presidents is a great start. This need not be confrontational. So that is one area. Now, the Biden economic team is coming into office, and it's too early to judge as to where they will come down on the many issues that remain from mm-hmm. the Trump administration, including many executive orders that constrained Chinese companies in America. And I'm certainly not going to prejudge that. All of government approach towards China will no doubt continue. Competition towards China will no doubt continue, but the framing of that competition in more confrontational tone will hopefully be toned down, allowing the space for pragmatic collaboration with China in climate change, COVID, anti-terrorism, anti-narcotics, and many other areas where we have a common concern. So the change of tone is important. There probably will not be a dramatic shift in either competition on the technology side or the diplomatic side, perhaps even the ideological side. But that competition could be a lot more creative and less confrontational. And I think that that is an important change.
Great, thank you.
Another difference that we see, if we look at the administration's statements about how it wants to handle questions related to TikTok and WeChat in the short term, for example, is the Biden administration has said that it wants to look at the merits of these claims under law. And that's a big shift from treating these companies based on imaginable worst case scenarios, which seemed to be the case previously. As far as we can tell from the public statements of the administration, they'll be looking at these cases primarily, or at least initially, through a legal lens rather than simply through a national security lens. Another thing that struck me during our conference and since is that we speak of bridging security and economic concerns as though these two are parallel. But there are many important senses in which they're not parallel at all. One of which, and I think this makes a big difference for the Biden administration, is that we understand our economic concerns vis-a-vis China fairly well. There are decisions to be made, but you can define what those interests are and why they're interests. Our security interests remain to be defined. And this, to me, is one of the great challenges for the Biden administration. What is the China challenge or the China threat, if you like, specifically? Under the Trump administration, security sort of ruled all, and worst case scenarios, the worst things that we could imagine, were assumed to be operative on the parts of the Chinese. If corporations, if universities, if NGOs, if the many Americans who work with China are going to be able to work with China in our national interests, knowing there's a competition, we need better guidance. And that includes real specificity about the nature of the challenge from China, the duration, the stakes, what it's likely to cost. And these are the big strategic questions that I hope to have answered by the Biden administration as clearly as possible. You don't get perfect clarity. This is a very dynamic situation. Fairly early on, because we can't speak of security and economic interests unless we've defined the security interests, and that's never really been done since we entered into this new era of competition.
Chris, let me add the multilateral element here as well. I think the trade community was very pleased that the U.S. agreed to the appointment of a new WTO Director General Ngozi. The world is relieved that the United States has rejoined the WHO and indeed paid up dues and working member in good standing of the World Health Organization to address COVID challenges. So the multilateral arena is going to help to shape our competition and our cooperation with China going forward. And that's a very good thing. For both countries to constrain themselves to those multilateral institutions pursuing global goods puts us changes the fabric of the debate and puts it in a much more constructive form, in my view. And also, it allows us to implement policies once decided. The unilateral mano a mano approach is only so useful. Much better for us to compete in arenas where we can win, including the multilateral arena, where we have great strengths and where we're going to see a new and renewed emphasis in terms of the U.S.-China relationship. Thank you.
Yeah, no, thanks. I mean, I think definitely the multilateral aspect is a strength of the U.S. vis-a-vis, you know, its position in China. So it makes sense to, you know, focus much more there as opposed to being unilateral. And I'd like to actually, you know, though still sort of think within the U.S., going back a little bit to what Robert was saying about, you know, what actually is the China challenge and sort of a need for it not to be necessarily just like an existential threat, like some, you know, folks, you know, have said, but get more guidance, you know, into the nature of it. And, you know, one of the questions that have come in, you know, relates, I think, a little bit to, you know, you mentioned WeChat and TikTok regarding, you know, sort of privacy of information, you know, sort of security of data, And, you know, I'd love to hear your thoughts about how to think about that, because there's a variety of different ways, you know, the individual, the questioner asks about, you know, things like medical data, you know, military and aerospace data. I mean, obviously there's a lot of nuance in thinking about, you know, data as a resource, and particularly vis-a-vis things like WeChat and TikTok bans. I'd love to hear, you know, your thoughts on that. Maybe I'm not sure who the best to start off with that is. Craig, do you want to start?
Yeah, let me start out. One of the proposals raised during our recent conference, which I heartily subscribe to, is that a new science and technology and data office should be erected within the White House to coordinate both U.S. government policy on those subjects, as well as to coordinate with our allies, and then on the basis of that, negotiate with the Chinese. And I think that that's a very solid proposal coming out of the conference. There are many elements of this, and we could talk about export controls, investment licensing, or investment approvals, and data. And all of them are important. They are three different kind of branches of governance or regulation. And all of them need a strategic framework and a coordinated approach, rather than each of the Department of Commerce worrying about export controls, Department of State worrying about clean channels, and other fragmentation within the government, multiple agencies working on all of them. So this is an area where contestation between the United States and China will probably remain, and where the United States could do a better job at coordinating among various interests. China has surged in its ability to innovate across multiple different industries. China has a quarter of the total STEM workers in the world and graduates approximately three times as many STEM workers as the United States on an annual basis. Further, they have a plan to excel in many industries of the future. And so I think it behooves us to work, to coordinate on this issue internally, to work closely with our allies, and then to negotiate with the Chinese to ensure that they meet their commitments under the WTO, or other multilateral fora. I would note that recently the MOFCOM, or the Ministry of Commerce of China, has put the CPTPP agreement on its website. Now, that is a very interesting development. It is indicative to the provinces and to the municipalities around China and state-owned enterprises that they should study this document and begin to prepare to implement it. Now, the CPTPP has very good innovation-related disciplines within it. And I think that this opens the door for potentially some useful discussion with the Chinese, along with CPTPP partners. And of course, the Europeans have proposed a trade and technology transatlantic council, another very interesting idea, which in my view should be pursued.
Did you have anything on top of that, Robert?
I would just add, I thought that one of the biggest takeaways coming out of our conference was that we had, I think, on fairly good authority, reports from people who know the Hill very well from both sides of the aisle, that there is zero chance of rejoining CPTPP under any circumstances, that there is simply no appetite for that. And one of the things that we discussed it at some length, this one's a dead letter. And obviously a number of us connected to the conference were hoping that that might be something that could be done during this administration, but we were told that Congress is in no mood.
Interesting. Returning a little bit to what some of Craig was saying around these different, you know, sort of multilateral frameworks, you know, on technology with Europe. You know, I'm curious. You know, you mentioned the WTO. You know, some of the proposals, you know, made in China 2025, you know, have been critiqued for potentially being, you know, in violation of the WTO. And I'm curious, you know, they've reformulated that in these strategic industries, you know, big focus on, you know, things like AI, machine learning, et cetera. You know, what's your sense of, you know, what the U.S. can do as far as, you know, its own, you know, not necessarily industrial policy, but as far as, shaping industry in a way that it can be competitive against China that is investing so much in a very centralized way in these technologies.
I think that, there is no doubting China's commitment to advancing its science and technology establishment and molding its society in accordance to new technologies. And they have the money and the technology and the people and the will to do so. And that does create, indeed, a very interesting set of challenges for the United States, for Europe, and indeed the rest of the world. On the U.S. side, I think that we have great traditional strengths that are the gift that have kept giving for the last 150 or 250 years, and will probably give for the next 250 years. And that is the diversity and the strength and openness and academic disciplines of our great universities and our innovative structures. The United States was born on an idea, and that is free markets in ideas, religion, goods, products, free markets in as much as we can. And that has delivered beautifully for our country and will continue to do so. That said, the government has withdrawn from funding R&D and could certainly increase the government's contribution to R&D, at least to the percentages that we had enjoyed in the post-war era. I think also critically, keeping our universities and laboratories, as well as corporations, open for collaboration around the world is critical. Chinese companies, R&D companies, high-tech companies, when you go in, you only hear Mandarin. There are very few other languages spoken. In American high-tech companies, it's just a United Nations, just a cornucopia of languages and cultures. Right. And that is our strength and something that we should double down on.
Let me ask a follow-up to that. Go ahead. Do you have something to add?
I don't want to pour a cold bucket of water on what Craig said, all of which I agree with. You know, diversity, innovation, creativity, political, cultural, pluralism, you know, long may they reign. But China's got two great tricks, speed and scale. And we haven't, our innovation, our sort of suite of strengths that Craig has described have never had to deal with that before. And this has implications in almost every aspect of Biden's project of national restoration, including you asked about, you know, prospects for something more like an industrial policy in the United States, at least in certain sectors. And Senator Rubio and others have called for this. And this would of course be a sea change. If it's desirable, if it's doable, it's going to be on a fairly slow boat. And this is again where China's speed and scale keep coming into play. And I've been wondering in sort of my sort of dark nights of the soul, more pessimistic modes, if America's great virtues that Craig just described, you know, were they historically construed or historically better suited to one era than another? When we have a wealthy, large, fast China, if we were to go to industrial policy, say the case of rare earths or biopharmaceuticals, right, could we do it in a time horizon that made any sense? And so one of the things in relation to this that concerns me, we're talking about the Biden administration's approach to China, is that very understandably, Biden has said he wants to focus on national restoration first. No free trade agreements until we've rebuilt our infrastructure and workers are more competitive. We need to get our own house in order. And I certainly agree with that, except that our house is never in order. And China's on the move. And so we can't slow walk this thing while China's speeding up. We've got to walk on both legs, whether it's in the area of industrial policy or goosing rare earths processing, whatever it may be. So I wholly, deeply agree with Craig about our strengths. I just worry that they've never faced a test like this before, and we may need to add some strengths to that list. So again,
but that's a very interesting sort of, you know, theory and sounds very plausible. And even, you know, I'd love to follow up with you, Robert, also, but to think more about some of the strengths that Craig had mentioned, you know, these in our universities and companies, the just vast diversity, which I think over the last 4 years has been a little bit on the decline with some of the immigration policies and limiting of visas. You know, and what's your sense about how that will change and or should change to try to, you know, continue to, you know, really build on some of the diversity that has traditionally been the strength of U.S. innovation and U.S. business more generally?
Robert. Sure. Well, I think here the Biden administration will benefit from a lot of the work that began under the Trump administration, not work done so much by the Trump administration, but launched, for example, like by the NDAA, which set up commissions at the National Academies of Science, Engineering, and Medicine, and within OSTP, the White House science advisor, looking at various academic subdisciplines to ask specific questions about how sensitive they were, in fact, and at what levels, with an eye toward maximizing the openness of universities, the internationalization of universities, including their openness to Chinese scholars, you know, from whose work we've benefited immeasurably in every discipline for over 40 years. This has been repeatedly understated over the past 5 years. But that doesn't mean there are no threats. So those commissions, their work is ongoing. And I think we'll be seeing some of the results of that soon. And they're trying to take what they've called, I think it was originally a Secretary Gates's phrase of small yards, high fences, describe the truly sensitive areas as narrowly as possible and then make them as secure as possible while honoring openness. There are also other ongoing legislative efforts, including some major legislation now being drafted on the Hill, which is also aimed at protecting our innovation system while recognizing that its greatest strength has been openness and internationalization. So I think that with a lot of rough spots over the past 4 years, and again, with an over-securitization of these questions about the academy, I think we ended up getting the questions about right and the dispositions about right. So now we're waiting for some of that, those research findings to come out as a guide to policy. So it's not the year zero for Biden on this stuff. There has been excellent ongoing work from the academy, from industry that he'll be able to draw on.
That's great to hear, relatively optimistic. Craig, did you have anything to add on the sort of university and human capital flow point?
Yeah, I would only add that every university has its own procedures and processes, and many have tightened up over the last year and a half, 2 years or so. And that's a very, that's a very good thing to see. Procedures concerning conflict of interest, for example, may not have been clear as they should have been. Processes of reporting income from foreign laboratories, for example, might not have been required in the past. All of that transparency is a very good thing. The more transparency, the better, and the more collaboration in that transparent framework is welcome. But conflict of interest and moral hazard and thousand talents type of activities that are unclear to the American host university, that type of activity should be curtailed.
Yeah, definitely. I think then there needs to be a big differentiation between espionage and fraud in some way, which I think sometimes in the media, maybe some of the investigations that's sort of presented in a little bit, you know, not
clear actually what the actual underlying issue is. I know as an academic with some experience in China, it's surprising to me that some of these transparency issues, because at least the universities I've been at are very conscientious in asking faculty multiple times a year about what their outside activities are, are they earning any income? Is there, any connection to any universities in China? So it's interesting to me that, there continues to be this transparency issue, but I agree that it should be actually emphasized a bit more. The one question we have that came in sort of as a follow-up to this discussion, and particularly, around the sort of small yard, high fences idea of sort of, relatively narrowly defining an interest area and then creating large barriers, is any sort of specific examples in maybe even biology or medicine or high tech to sort of give listeners a good sense of, actually what that could mean?
I don't think we'll know until we get the research products. Of course, all of the universities that have been doing classified work, they've won grants to conduct classified work. Those laboratories have never been open to foreign scholars. And so that shouldn't be a major issue. I do know that they're looking, at sub-disciplines. They're not going to say something like aeronautics and astronautics. It will be sub-disciplines that have specific applications, say, to hypersonic glide reentry vehicles, that sort of thing. That's the narrow gauge approach that they're going to be taking. But I don't think we'll know, and I don't think there's that much point in speculating right now as to how they're going to carve that up. But it will not just be directed toward China. It will be designated countries of high security concern. So this will be Russia, Iran, of course, North Korea, Cuba, China, maybe a handful of others. And it will not be a ban of all scholars. It will be a ban on scholars in subdisciplines at certain levels, whether that's postdoctoral or whatever it is. It's certainly not at the undergraduate level and probably not at the master's level. So I think on this one, we really just need to wait and see.
Interesting development is that the Department of Commerce is trying to define emerging technologies and foundational technologies, so as to be able to bring them under export controls if necessary. And I was very pleased to see that they are working with our European friends and allies and colleagues on this, or at least consulting with them. Because I think that the unilateral American approach is only going to be so effective. The United States has certainly no monopoly on any of these emerging technologies. And at least in my view, collaboration transatlantic is a useful paradigm going forward, both to advance our own R&D agenda, but also as a way to address some of the excesses within China's R&D establishment, and at least indirectly encourage the Chinese R&D establishment to recognize the problems that it has with fraud and abuse and patent problems and other types of problems that are common in China. So transatlantic collaboration here, at least in my view, is very positive.
Positive note for some of your listeners on these issues is that our new DNI, Director of National Intelligence, Avril Haines, throughout most of 2020, this is not a secret, was leading a project at the Weatherhead Institute at Columbia. It was a combined project with the Johns Hopkins National Physics Lab, looking at these issues of research integrity and defending the innovation system, and sponsored a number of papers by American academics that took a really granular look. A lot of the accusations that we've heard about Chinese scholars over the past 3 or 4 years, they've been, I wouldn't say they're exactly evidence-free zones, but one would have wished for a little bit more specificity. And so she did this and ran this, I thought, very, very good project. I wanted to recommend one of the scholars who's at Yale on this, a guy named Remco Zwetsu, who really got the data on how many Chinese are here, what disciplines they're in, whether they are replaceable or not. And the whole project came down on very much on the side of, we need openness and internationalization, and we need these Chinese students. And the person who ran that project is now sitting at DNI. And so she's well-versed in all of these issues, as are many of her colleagues who have gone into the Biden administration. They've been on this one for 3 or 4 years. And I think basically with the right dispositions, I'm fairly optimistic.
Yeah, no, definitely. I mean, as from the university standpoint where I sit, I mean, this, you know, having more sort of, you know, granular look at things is so well needed. I know I teach at a business school, and there's so many blanket, which really has very little, I think, national security concerns, you know, not high tech focus or sort of sensitive research area. But still, you know, many sort of there's blanket restrictions where, you know, I can't even talk to some folks from various universities that are on sort of the 7 universities list where I have sort of friends and colleagues. So it's, I definitely think this is a step in the right direction. One of the questions that come in sort of looks at this from the opposite perspective. And I think it's a really important one, you know, given both of your background to think about, you know, it's from the U.S. understanding of China and new China scholars, new people interested in working in and understanding China. You know, I teach a class on doing business in China, you know, much less interest in this recently. I think on SubChina, maybe a month or two ago, there was an article about, you know, there was, you know, sort of retreat of folks studying China and China hands, so to speak. So I'd love to hear your thoughts about how we can keep open the dialogue in that direction too, and really continue to foster expertise on China within the United States.
Craig, why don't you go first?
Yeah.
So there is no doubt that we need a lot more China expertise in the United States. Let me approach this from a, if you will, a diplomatic perspective. I think that throughout the Foreign Service and the diplomatic corps, that there is an urgent need for China expertise. Far too few people who speak fluent Mandarin, much less other dialects within the Foreign Service. And unfortunately, it's become more difficult for Chinese speakers, particularly those who have spent time in China to pass the security clearances to enter the Foreign Service. To serve at an embassy, one needs a top secret clearance, and that's not easy to get. I am hopeful that the Foreign Service and the US government and those institutions that do require a security clearance will welcome those who have actually spent time in China. Otherwise, we might find ourselves in the contradictory situation of needing that China expertise, but having regulations that won't allow us to hire our own people who do have that. So at least in my view, it would be useful to take another look at those regulations and higher up, particularly within the Foreign Service, which has lost a lot of expertise over the last 4 years.
And in addition to what Craig just said, and I agree strongly, you know, the young Americans who spent many years in China doing many things, you know, making friends, sometimes, you know, marrying people, they're precisely the folks we need, and they can't get into a lot of these agencies. But there's another piece. It's actually even worse than Craig says. We have a really huge reservoir of Chinese speakers. They're Chinese American.
Right.
They're Chinese American. That's where the expertise is now, linguistic, you know, bicultural, professional expertise. And they too, if they come into government, face a lot of restrictions for serving in China in many cases. And that's another piece, together with what Craig just mentioned, that we really have to look at, because of course that's where the expertise resides, and we keep much of it on the other side of the door.
Great. We had a question come in that I think sort of also relates to this sort of really, you know, bridging understanding, in economic ways as well. And it's regard to CFIUS, you know, the Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States. You know, how effective is it now in protecting U.S. national security and interests? You know, on the one hand, the questioner asks, you know, it's, it could be a boon because it encourages people-to-people interaction, job creation. But then conversely, you know, it could be, you know, a curse with China, you know, stealing business secrets and espionage, et cetera. So I'm curious what your sense is, and maybe we can start with Robert on CFIUS and how it meets that sort of delicate balance.
Well, Craig is far more knowledgeable about this than I am. CFIUS, of course, does most of its work in secret, and the criteria that it uses for its work have been shifting a lot over recent years. I don't know whether we've heard anything about how the Biden administration plans to look at this or not. Certainly recently it's erred on the side of saying no to everything, whereas I think it used to be that there was an assumption that these applications were worthwhile projects. That assumption shifted during the Trump administration, but where it is now, I don't know, Craig, if we know anything about that under Biden.
So Chinese investment in the United States has declined precipitously, some 90% from 2017 to 2019. I don't think that the 2020 figures are in yet, but nothing has changed. And as a result of that, Americans employed by Chinese companies have also declined. Some 30,000 Americans fewer are currently employed by Chinese companies than in 2017. In my view, that's very unfortunate, particularly if that Chinese investment had been directed towards the economically deprived parts of the United States, as much of it had been. The CFIUS program is designed around export controls to protect American national security interests, but it has been applied much more broadly. And I think that tailoring it to industries where there are real national security concerns, particularly in high tech, makes a lot of sense. CFIUS and FIRMA are necessary. However, applying that to a yarn factory in Arkansas or a fish factory, a fish processing facility on the Ohio River doesn't make sense, doesn't make economic sense, and hurts American working families. So I think a recalibration here would be very welcome and is urgently needed. The United States has a large trade deficit with China. Traditionally, the way to address a large trade deficit would be to welcome a foreign direct investment in the industries that had been exporting to the U.S. If we close that off, then we condemn ourselves to a long-term structural imbalance with the Chinese that none of us want.
Yeah, makes a lot of sense. So, I mean, I think definitely a theme of our conversation is just a need to, you know, sort of understand the nuances. And it sounds like in a number of different, you know, areas from, you know, potentially CFIUS to, you know, various academic areas that those, it's sort of ongoing, the understanding of that. And hopefully those will be clarified soon so that we can actually engage on them in the Biden administration. I'd love to turn a little bit to, you know, some more positive, you know, we've hit some positive things, but mostly it's been in the areas of, you know, restrictions or where we can sort of, you know, be better in our relations. You know, there's a number of areas where it's been discussed that the U.S. and China should really collaborate. You know, there's really very strong shared interest. I mean, this could, you know, climate, you know, environment issues, potentially around like food security policy, things like that. I'd love to hear, and maybe we'll also start with you again, Robert, you know, what are some of the areas that, you know, we could have some quick wins and really, you know, work together in a productive way with China?
Well, I think that the list has become sort of Lao Sheng Chang Kan. It's almost become a cliché-ic list. There's an awful lot of talk about working together on climate change, although a lot of that togetherness is largely symbolic in international forum like the Paris Climate Agreement.
Right.
The Chinese have tended to look at this in terms of actual policies and reduction in emitted hydrocarbons as, you know, good on good. You do the best you can do. I'll do the best I can do. If everyone does the best they can do country by country, that's the best we can get. Where is the detailed technical collaboration in that area? There may be some prospects for that, but it hasn't been described. This has become a little bit of a throwaway line. Of course, we can collaborate. I think you mentioned food safety. I think that the issue of safety generally, before all the talk of decoupling, food safety, biopharmaceutical safety, consumer product safety, something of extremely high concern around the world, that there are actually detailed technical ways to collaborate more closely on, is a major area. The pandemic side, in theory, yes, but we're a long way from true collaboration in this region. But certainly we need to start talking to each other. China's not yet willing to get involved in arms control talks. Okay, we understand their position. You know, we have a much bigger arsenal. China's view has always been you reduce down to our level and then we can talk. But there can be other kinds of talks about safety and non-proliferation, as well as sort of proto-arms control talks that can start now and that are in our joint interest. One of the questions about that, and recently Chinese leaders have spoken to this in a discouraging way, is whether China is going to, as a matter of its political culture, can it cooperate with us in some areas where we're really competing in a distrustful, confrontational, non-win-win way in other regions? This is something that I think we're historically a little bit better at, putting these things in boxes. China likes people to either be friends or something else, but they don't like the simultaneous, you know, pat on the back, knife in the ribs. It just doesn't sit well. And so a couple of, you know, their leaders recently have said, of course, if we're going to cooperate, this would entail your silence about Xinjiang, about Hong Kong. And that is simply not going to happen. So are there prospects? Are there needs to cooperate? Yes. Can China do it? We don't know. They have done it in the past, despite their rhetoric now about not being able to separate these different areas. They've, in fact, done it regularly. It's never set well. But that's a big question for them. We're mostly focusing in this discussion, rightly so, on our views and what we may be able to do and how we should measure the challenge from China, how we should frame threats. Of course, there's a mirror questions on the other side. There are real threats. There are real challenges. China itself, you know, you asked about training young sinologists. China has made it much harder to have a career in China in a number of ways. It relates to their visa policies and their hiring policies. So there's a mirror discussion to be had on the other side of all this.
Yeah, good point. I don't know, Craig, if you have anything else to add on that.
I regret that we've kind of lost our muscle memory on cooperation, because there's so much potentially where we could cooperate on the academic side, where the Chinese should open up their archives and welcome American researchers. Certainly the story in the media is very sad going both ways. And that is an area that I would be hopeful that there could be further collaboration. Visas in general have become very difficult going both ways. And without a little bit more of a liberal visa policy, it's just going to be hard to get nearly anything done. On the Chinese side, their crackdown on NGOs has not helped at all vis-a-vis collaboration.
Right.
And this is creating a climate of distrust and an inability to get things done. One example would be labor inspectors. The Chinese should open up the whole country for labor inspections so that companies can buy from where they need to. Supervision over companies and this type of inspection over routine commercial activities makes collaboration very difficult. And particularly as we go into a Winter Olympics, if we're to have a normal Winter Olympics, where we need a lot more openness and ability to for civil society to move back and forth. And right now, that's just highly circumscribed and something that should be addressed as quickly as possible.
Yeah, thank you for mentioning that. I was actually asked that question to have it be, you know, a little more optimistic about here are things that we can work on. But I think you highlighting some of these tensions are really important. And it makes it hard sometimes to actually argue the case that we should engage more when there is a lot of these, you know, sort of, yeah, crackdowns on NGOs, crackdowns on journalists, you know, restrictive visas, and the variety of other things that are occurring. It makes it hard actually from the US side to effectively engage. I have a question. We have a couple questions in the Q&A I want to make sure we try to get to. So there's a question about the U.S. and Taiwan and asking about, you know, the future of that relationship under the Biden administration. Do either of you have any thoughts on that?
Go ahead. Well, I think it was important that the Biden administration came out and said that we are going to continue to operate under the One China policy. Of course, there are flexible interpretations of the One China policy. And the Biden administration has also made clear that they will continue to look for certain kinds of international space for Taiwan. But I think that we will be seeing less of the provocations for provocation's sake, back and forth high-level visits designed not necessarily to advance an agenda, but to have China see that we'll do it. I hope that there will be no further talk of military, other, you know, ship visits to Taiwan. The Chinese have been very clear that the day an American destroyer goes into the Taiwanese port of Kaohsiung, that's the day that missiles fly. And I think we need to bear in mind a colleague of both Craig and mine, Ambassador Stapleton Roy, makes this point a lot, that if you look back at the history of three-way relations since 1979, cross-strait relations have worked out best for the people of Taiwan when mainland China was confident about its relationship with the United States. That's a very important part of the historical record. And so I think that our watchword for now should be not backing off of the sense that China is a strategic competitor, because it is, but we can aim for stabilization and less unpredictability in every sphere, and especially in the area of Taiwan, which is now more dangerous than it's been in decades. And I think that we do well to keep Ambassador Roy's historical observation in mind as we do that.
Yeah, we're close to time, and there's a couple questions on one of the things that I actually found to be one of the more interesting aspects of our conversation. You know, Robert's point that actually the era of where, you know, sort of diversity and openness and inclusion, you know, leads to, you know, really effective innovation, et cetera, you know, might be over, might be a strong way to put it. But, you know, this era we're in now where China can do things with scale, with speed, provides a whole other way of that sort of logic of, you know, organizing innovation. And a couple, you know, the questions asking, you know, how can the rest of the world compete against the scale and speed model? Do either of you have any ideas about, you know, we can work multilaterally, or the EU can work, or the US can work? What sort of things can actually combat that, you know, that model?
I think that the Chinese model is indeed very formidable. They have world-beating companies, and particularly innovation coming out of Shenzhen is extraordinary. At the same time, as was in the case of Japan 25 years ago, the Chinese do lack the diversity that American and European firms enjoy. Further, there is a tendency to focus domestically on the Chinese domestic market rather than a global market. And so the U.S. Together with European and Japanese companies, who are inherently diverse, inherently global, who have been doing this for a long time, have formidable competitive capabilities, whereas Chinese companies have formidable handicaps and a lack of experience that they're facing. So we mustn't pretend that we can't, that the Chinese are 10 foot tall and they put on their trousers both legs at a time. Quite the contrary. And as we move forward, there's also a rethink within China
a growing interest in antitrust, a growing interest in party control over technology and over companies, a growing desire for more technology under the government supervision. And that is not something that the rest of the world wants and is certainly violative of the original spirit of the internet, which is clearly welcome in many other countries around the world. So we definitely have two innovation models that are competing with each other. Yep. And it'll be incredibly interesting to see which one proves dominant in which industries.
Great, thanks. Robert, this was your point initially. What are your thoughts on this?
We're just that Ambassador Allen has given us an excellent answer. I think that's exactly the way to think about it.
Excellent. Well, I just want to take a second to thank you both. I mean, I've learned a lot, and actually I'm feeling pretty excited about the next number of years to be, here, watching as things continue to develop, hopefully in a positive way, having both of you involved in helping, set agendas, talk to leaders, really push this. A theme that I got was this idea that, we just need to really, dig in a much more nuanced way to understand, what actually might be a threat, what actually might be an economic opportunity. And so I just want to thank you both for joining us today. And just very much appreciate it. Thank you very much. And thank you all for joining in. Really enjoyed the discussion.
Thank you, Chris.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us on China Corner Office. This podcast was produced and edited by Chris Marquis, Kaiser Guo, and Jason McRonald. Did you enjoy the show? If so, leave us a review on Apple Podcasts and let us know your thoughts. And don't forget to subscribe to the feed for alerts when new episodes are published. See you soon.